doesn't have to star Will Smith, but not a horrible starting point. In honor of Collateral Beauty, what's a movie with a plot that needs to be seen to be believed?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the movie that does star Will Smith. It's 7 pounds. It is the original Collateral Beauty, as far as I can tell, because the twist in that movie, I promise you, you do not see coming from those trailers.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, The Point. It's an animated movie by Fred Wolf, based on some Harry Nilsson music. You should look it up.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with every single Nicholas Sparks adaptation, because they all start the same, love, and they all end in twisted, crazy, am I really watching this moments.
That is not true. Just the one.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and while I am going to go with The Lovely Bones, I do want to point back to Katie's choice and just underscore how insane Will Smith is. All this New Age or Scientology mumbo-jumbo in his head is leading him to think that these are meaningful movies. It is sad.
Sad.
That's the bashing Will Smith lightning round quote. We never...
And Nicholas Sparks.
Yeah,
I swear it's just that one Nicholas Sparks movie with the ghost that has a crazy twist. The other ones are all just like, huh.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 148. It's Thursday, December 15th, and on this day in 1973, Pirates of the Caribbean The Ride opened at Disneyland. And what, 30 years later, Pirates of the Caribbean The Movie would change Johnny Depp's career forever, for better or for worse. Yeah.
Some great now, animatronics on Pirates of the Caribbean.
And Dave, as you pointed out, Johnny Depp is now part of the Pirates of the Caribbean ride in what, China?
In all of them, actually, now, but very much featured in China, where it's something like Jack Sparrow's Lost Treasure or what have you.
In Johnny Depp's biopic, there will be a scene. The first scene will be little Johnny Depp riding the original Pirates of the Caribbean ride and seeing the pirate, dreaming of becoming the pirate. And then flash forward, he's a pirate. It's a really bad movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of dramatic tension in this movie you're talking about.
Dad, wouldn't you start 21 Jump Street and like... Then he's like, I'm sick of this job. And then he goes to Disneyland.
He's always
it only includes his cameo in the 21 Jump Street movie.
Just the entire biopic is leading up to and shooting that.
So we're coming up on the end of the year. Next week, we're going to have our top 10s episode. So that's exciting. And it's a great time to leave us reviews. Has anyone done so recently?
Yes. But,
whoa.
I think you'll understand my hesitation when you listen to our review.
Fun.
It is by Matt Fuck You.
Cool.
Here we go.
I don't know if the name was specifically created for this review. He gave us this is his only review, and so it would lead me to think so. But on the other hand, he did give us 4 stars, which.
Hey.
As far as star ratings go, is not as bad as it gets.
Should I pre-apologize for anything here? Is this...
No, it's very brief, but not perhaps to the point. Matt Fuck You, whose review is headlined, The Only Reason to Listen to This Podcast, says, "Look, I'm not a perfect person. There's many things I wish I didn't do, but I continue learning. I never meant to do those things to you. So I have to say before I go that I just want you to know... I found a reason for me to change who I used to be. A reason to start over, and the reason is you." And if those words sound familiar to you, there's probably a good reason for that. I'll let you discover what that is
for
yourselves.
Wait, can I guess? Do you know? Is that a Hoobastank song? Oh my god.
Yes,
it's a Hoobastank
song.
Fuck
me indeed.
Now, did we talk about Hoobastank on this podcast?
Not that I know.
Oh, you weren't there for the all Hoobastank edition of Fighting in the World.
Yeah, you guys did that while I was gone.
I sat that one out,
That's
well,
one way to leave a review on this show. You can do
you know
that.
What? We appreciate the star rating, so it sure.
Certainly puts us in our place.
Yeah, fuck you, Matt.
Yeah,
no.
Please understand why now.
Yeah, please follow Matt Fuck You's example, at least in some respects, and leave us reviews. They can be... song lyrics. I think it's fair to say, speak on behalf of my co-hosts, to say preferably they would be your own words, maybe at least in addition to song lyrics. But whatever, all reviews, especially the nice ones, are good for us to have, so thank you.
Yeah. So there are two movies set in outer space opening this holiday season, and we're going to talk about both of them on this episode, but because Passengers is the one that doesn't have a huge, rich mythology behind it, we're going to talk about that one briefly right now. Patches and David, you guys both just saw it. I've heard things about this movie varying from it's a complete awful disaster to it's not that bad. So which one of you would like to take
which side? I think we were spouting those two opinions exactly earlier.
Passengers does have a bit of a mythic history behind it. It was this film, which is directed by, today we call them computers, Morten Tildum.
Is it today we call them computers, or today we call it the internet? People keep computers.
No, it's computer.
Okay. This is computers. The ending of The Imitation Game.
Yes, for reference.
Which was Morten Tildum's previous film. It's made from a script by John Spates, the script that has been kicking around Hollywood for a very long time.
So many
time.
Jobs.
It got him a job writing Prometheus. That's how long the script has been around. The script earned him the job writing Prometheus, the film that sequel is now in post-production. So John Spates made the rounds of the script. You too can achieve your dreams if you write a sci-fi spec script with a very hooky premise. It's not very interesting that this movie was once going to be made with Keanu Reeves and Rachel McAdams 10 years ago, but the premise was catching, and you can understand why when you hear it, if you haven't already, which is that it is set on a spaceship that is making an intergalactic trip from Earth to another planet for people. It is not an arc. It is just Earth is not in any dire trouble, or so we're told. The whole movie takes place on the spaceship. But it's overcrowded and the rent is too damn high. So 5,000 souls
get on the spaceship Titanic, basically, which I think was a real video.
Yes, it is. It is essentially Titanic, because in the very, very beginning of the movie, the first shots, the spaceship encounters an asteroid field, and comets perforate the shield, and there are 5,000 people sleeping on board because the ship takes 90 years to get from Earth to
Homestead 2.
I can't remember what the planet. Homestead 2, right. And one of those sleeping people, his hibernation pod malfunctions, and he wakes up and finds himself with 90 years still to go on this trip, absolutely alone in a Wall-E-like spaceship. His name, and this is how you know the movie is going to be some dopey bullshit, is Jim Preston.
Oh, boy.
And he is played by Chris Pratt, who is half of the whitest movie of all time.
Now, let me stop you before you say anything else, David.
Wait, hold on.
Because we're going to issue a total spoiler warning for this segment.
Not total.
I mean, there are not many things left to spoil, but the gigantic big spoiler of this movie, and
but we will
properly
say
talk
if,
about it.
If you're on the fence about this, the only thing that we're going to talk about, what we're worried about spoiling for you, happens 30
yes,
minutes.
Yes, but saying
into
anything more
but is
could
in
insinuate
none
what
of
it is.
The promotional materials.
Correct.
The premise of this movie is being deliberately held from the promotional materials.
Some of it. Right. I don't. Well, saying anything more will spoil it. So if you
but
are worried
I don't
about
believe that,
jump ahead.
We are. This is out of an abundance of caution. I do not at all believe that we would be
of course you don't.
Ruining any potential enjoyment. But I knew this for years because this was part of the log
Stop
line
reading
when the script
movie
was
news.
Going around town.
You movie news addict. Let movies just come out and be.
This is 10 years ago, Patches. This is before I had learned my lesson.
When you had 18 Ain't It Cool News accounts.
Exactly. I had them on multiple screens and windows.
Movie
and
rat what does, yeah, what does, 69. Yeah, well.
David was first on every comment section. Anyway.
Very on brand. Anyway, the spoiler warning now in effect. Our hero Jim Preston.
Totally
after inane. a year in the spaceship by himself, hanging out with android bartender Michael Sheen.
Why does this ship have a bartender if everyone's
because
in
theory everyone's supposed to wake up with 4 months left to go before the planets like get assimilated, just you know. Prepare and meet and socialize and have a good time. It's still like a cruise. But, so you wake up with 4 months
left
and have a good
begets, time. Your question begets another question, which is how do you have one bartender, albeit an android, for 5,000 people?
That's just one section of the thing. There's probably other bars. There's definitely other restaurants, as we see. There's a lot of fun things to do on this ship. You can go swimming. You can play Dance Dance Revolution from the future, which is a hologram game. Oh, it's so fun.
You can watch movies, but not any specific movies.
Yes.
Because they cut away whenever they go to the movie theater.
You can even go outside the ship for some reason, which seems extremely unsafe. You can go for a walk on the shell of the spaceship, even though it's rotating.
For some reason, terrible. Or because it might come in handy during a third act climax. Who's to say? But the Jim Preston is very bored, very lonely, and scared at the prospect of spending the rest of his days absolutely alone on this ship. And so, after a long dark night of the soul, makes the fateful and extremely difficult decision to wake up another passenger. And of course, he chooses the sexiest passenger he can find. And he supposedly falls in love with her based on her writing.
David.
Yes.
He falls in love with her based on what?
Based on
she's a writer.
Yeah, she's a journalist.
And he reads her. Yeah, he's a journalist. And he reads her stuff. And he tells the bartender, who's an android.
You know how Rory Gilmore wrote one great New Yorker article? This is kind of like that.
And she tells he tells the android that he feels like her writing was written just for him. Now, her plan is to go in this 90 or more year sleep and go to the new planet for a year and then turn around and come right back. There are all sorts of very silly things that you can extrapolate from this that the movie quickly flashes upon. But anyway, I'm rambling. He wakes her up and suddenly they are alone. And it is, after the initial shock, sort of utopian. They are running around. They are fucking. They are swimming. They are eating. And things are great. And then, of course, she learns that he woke her up and she be mad. And they fight, and then more things happen that are not worth spoiling here. But
third act of a blockbuster movie happens, and
exactly.
And Lawrence Fishburne shows up somehow because he's in the trailers.
Is he?
Whoa!
Yeah, he's.
I don't think we need to spoil that.
I've seen a lot of. Okay, well, somehow he shows up. I know this from the TV ads.
Maybe,
but now that I have done all the setting up patches, whose opinion differs from mine on this film? Please tell us.
Let's just say Dave walked out hating it, and I went, wait. I thought everyone would think this was romantic and fun.
Oh, boy.
This is not Titanic. That's how we open this segment. Let's just say this is not Titanic. This has no vision to it.
Do you think it's going to win as many Oscars as Titanic?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Morton Tilden, he's Oscar-nominated. What did I like about this movie? I actually do think they have a little bit of chemistry, these two. I'm not the biggest Jennifer Lawrence fan. I'm not kind of sold on her being this amazing chameleon of an actress. But here she has an energy, she has a playfulness, every time she says journalist, I cringed, but you just don't buy any of that. They have no life, they have no backstories, despite the whole movie being kind of predicated on them coming from different walks of life and going on this journey to another planet for some reason, then kind of falling into each other's arms. Still, it's just kind of elegantly told, it's laid back, it's not bombastic. These are just two people hanging out on a spaceship for a lot of time, being romantic and playful. And John Spaeth, you know, cut his teeth on this script, and Doctor Strange, Prometheus. He has an idea for how science fiction can work. This is very much like a Twilight Zone episode, expanded to allow for, like, what was the world back home like? How would the operations of the ship function? That kind of stuff is really fun. And for the first third, when Chris Pratt is going out of his mind, trying to entertain himself, a lot of that stuff comes up. So world building is enjoyable on some level. And then when they finally get together, I think they're really cute. It's just playful and fun. But as described, the third act is a total snooze. You know, it's very, very Hollywood and generic. And that's probably what's going to piss a lot of people off, because it has to set up so obviously the problems with the ship or the problems with the relationship. It's all going to be so obvious, but okay. I liked it.
Here's what you need to know about this movie.
And it's problematic as hell.
This is a movie where the end credits feature a originally recorded Imagine Dragons song. I don't know if I need to say anything else.
Okay, so you say it's playful and fun. She did not consent to spend her entire life on this spaceship.
Let me address this. As David was saying, wait, were we talking about this before the podcast or not?
This was before the podcast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm happy to say it now.
You should say it because, and then I want to address your point.
Okay. Now, Katie is absolutely right. She did not consent to being awoken. That is also the plot of the movie. I mean, we are not making movies that exist in a moral vacuum here where it's like all bad things need to be verboten. There's conflict. People are human.
She gets very, very upset, as you can imagine.
Yes. This is a movie about, and I'm being generous when I say that these characters are human. I mean, this is the dopiest shit of all time. It's a very entertaining movie, and occasionally it can be emotionally affecting, but it is, I said to Patches after the movie that I now think that there is a greater divide between studio films and independent films than there is between independent films and television or film and television as a whole. This is like an entirely other breed of species of entertainment. It's just so geared towards the lowest common denominator at all times. Everything is so vanilla white, and not just the color of their skin, but everything about it, the words they say to each other, the environments they're in, it's all so sleek and designed to play as broadly as possible.
This is not Solaris or something.
Right.
Like that.
I mean, it's just like this is a movie that they're willing to risk running afoul of people who, I don't know, have a very understandable desire to have more diversity or more of the real world reflected in these films, then they're willing to pay that price just to have it offend as few other markets as possible. But and it ends with an Imagine Dragons song. I mean, it's a Walmart, it's sci-fi for Walmart, and it's a waste of a really interesting premise, a premise that does, as Patches said, come to life every once in a while, even as hurried as the movie is. I mean, it's impatient. It doesn't let you sink in. You don't feel that year of his past when he is mulling over whether or not to wake somebody up. But yeah, she is furious at him. I mean, that is the whole second act.
But here's
of
the
movie.
Thing to address that. It's like, first off, if this ethical conversation can happen in a Walmart packaging, if it's bubble wrap for everyone on this planet to be able to see this movie or at least this country and indulge and kind of crack this nut. I mean, that's good, right? Like, we can have a cookie cutter bubblegum Hollywood movie that's still wrestling with this like really intense revelation. I mean, when she gets broken up about it, I was broken up about it. I'm like, how do you live on this ship with this guy who did this to you? This is horrible. A horrible thing has happened. But remember, and Katie, I definitely want to hear what you have to say about this movie when you see it eventually. And same with especially our female listeners, because I would wonder how they feel, because obviously they probably warm up a little bit or things bring them back together because they definitely go their separate ways for a little bit. But he went crazy. He like went Tom Hanks in Castaway crazy being alone on
this
ship.
They don't sell it is the problem.
Yeah.
Like,
it's not intense.
I mean, if they really sold that he had gone off the deep end, as they want you to believe, I think it would be a more nuanced characterization. Yeah. You could roll along with it. It really does, after 10 minutes of screen time, feel like he just got lonely and horny
totally true.
Was like, oh, hot blonde.
And if he's gone off the deep end, like, how is he supposed to then woo Jennifer Lawrence in this room?
Well, because he shaves before he wakes her up, of course.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, when you lose your crazy man beard, all of the craziness are in those strands of hair. So,
But, yeah, it's very unsatisfying. But I do think Patches is right that when future Americans are stranded on a spaceship for 90 years and are thinking about whether or not to wake up somebody who they have a romantic or sexual interest in, they will think back to this movie and be like, I'm glad that we had that conversation as a country.
I just like, I mean, and as I've been told, Jennifer Lawrence's character is named Aurora, which is, of course,
Aurora Dunn.
And they actually make love in front of an Aurora Borealis.
They do.
Oh, boy.
And then
culture is full of narratives of women being asleep and being woken up and true love's kiss and all this
Sleeping
stuff.
Beauty.
I just like, I don't need more of that. I don't need more stories in which women have no agency in choosing how their
fate. It would definitely be more interesting if she woke him up.
Yeah,
but
or way more.
As I suggested, that he die, and then she be left alone, and then eventually decide to wake someone else up.
Oh yeah. My god, that'd be fantastic.
But Katie, based on your very real and well-earned concerns, may I suggest that maybe you don't pay money to go see this movie?
I don't know that I will ever see Passenger. Okay. So I'm not trying to sit here and criticize a movie that I have not seen and don't intend to see, but I just it does not make me any more interested in seeing it, despite, and I think, David, what you were saying before we started recording is a story about forgiveness that's really interesting, you know, how you overcome betrayal. There have been a lot of interesting relationship movies about that. I don't know if I want this version
of it.
Well,
you can,
I don't know if I trust
forgive Morton Tilden.
Forgiveness.
And let him make the Imitation Game too.
when computers finally come to life.
Yeah, I mean, there's another movie in which there's a woman leading an intergalactic rebellion out there right now, like... I think I'll just go see that.
Why don't we talk about that one?
Well, we're going to talk about the Golden Globes first.
Okay. Yeah. Wait,
put a pin in that.
Do that segment. It's so much on my mind, I don't know where to start. It's that light in your eye, filling up that dark. Though I lost myself and the wisdom to you, you're my shoe.
We're going to talk about the Golden Globe nominations real quick. Caveat emptor, the Golden Globes are meaningless. They're not voted on by Oscar voters or really anyone in particular. But they're fun and they're an award show that we'll all be watching in January. So, Patches, you have not looked at the nominees at all, which I'm really impressed by.
No, but I kind of assume that David and Dave haven't either.
I saw some.
I eyed them over briefly and I rolled my eyes as hard and rolly as they could roll.
And then David
over
updated
the
awards blog.
Right. Over the Deadpool news in particular. But.
I'm going to guess about some of your eye-rolly ones and just rattle off my favorite shockers. Patches, the best actor in a comedy category. Two that you might expect, Colin Farrell in The Lobster and Ryan Gosling in La La Land. I feel like we can agree.
I don't know. Colin Farrell, I thought that might be too weird for people, so that's positive.
Well, he won for In Bruges, so the Golden Globes have a track record with this guy. Then you get Hugh Grant and Florence Foster Jenkins.
A lot of people were talking about him.
I feel like he's been also considered supporting in some circumstances.
Scandal.
Then we get into the fun ones. Jonah Hill for War Dogs.
That is a good movie. Did we ever talk about War Dogs on this podcast?
I don't know. I was gone when that happened.
Totally serviceable. It's like a fine feature article in a good magazine. Watch War Dogs. He's good in it.
And then Ryan Reynolds for Deadpool.
Now that's a travesty.
Which is also nominated for Best Comedy.
What the hell? I thought the Critics' Choice Awards was goofy enough.
Yeah, I mean, Deadpool was a huge, huge hit. It
was.
Who ever would have guessed that?
Did that blow up internationally, too? Dave, do you know if Deadpool is, like, a thing around the world?
I don't off the top of my head, but it would have to be if they're pushing it as hard as it is.
It made $419 million worldwide and $363 domestic. So
I think that the Deadpool nominations, I understand that they, I understand they don't make the choices necessarily based on trying to get ratings for the show. But we're not talking about the Oscars, where that would be impossible to game because you have so many people. We're talking about the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, so who knows? But
why did they overlook
him
from Green Lantern? That's the question.
The question you can ask.
But
every
I do think that this is the probably the biggest embarrassment is since Burlesque for the Golden Globes.
Oh, how about The Tourist, though? I think that was after
I agree. It was after Burlesque, but this is a bigger embarrassment than The Tourist and on par with Burlesque.
Wow. All right. So in the best comedy musical category itself, there's a good number of good choices. Then Deadpool. And then also Sing Street, my beloved Sing Street.
Oh, you scared me for a second. I thought you said Sing.
Oh, God.
And then Sing.
We'll talk about that at some point. All right, best actress in a comedy, Hailee Steinfeld for Edge of 17. That was a pleasant
surprise
for people who have seen that movie. And then also Lily Collins for Rules Don't Apply. I was not aware she was a lead actress in that movie or that it was a comedy.
I think it's like a not a slapsticky, just like a roll-licking fun Howard Hughes adventure, right?
By Golden Globe standards, I have absolutely no problem thinking of it as a comedy. It is as much of a comedy as dozens of different movies that they've considered comedies in the past. And in a movie that doesn't really have a lead, I mean, that's actually not true. Alden Ehrenreich is unimpeachably the lead of that movie. Lily Collins is a supporting actress. She just happens to have the largest female role.
Well, let's just say it's a makeup vote for Mirror Mirror, which she was wonderful.
Agreed.
There you go. Well, in the supporting actor category, because you've got Hugh Grant and as a lead actor in a comedy, that leaves room for Simon Helberg to be nominated for his role in Florence Foster Jenkins.
What? Is he the first Big Bang Theory to be nominated in a movie?
Maybe. I don't know. What's Kaley Cuoco been up to?
I see her in commercials.
Very, very timely. I'm happy that you mentioned that. Kaley Cuoco voices the very advanced Siri-like home AI system that James Franco's tech-zillionaire character has installed in his house in the new film, Why Him, in theaters this Friday.
So she'll be Gold Globe nominated for that next year? Indeed. Okay, and then rounding out supporting actor along with Mahershala Ali, Jeff Bridges, and Dev Patel in movies that we are expecting, Aaron Taylor-Johnson for Nocturnal Animals. Yes.
I mean,
did not know he was in that movie.
He's really good in that scene where he takes a shit on his porch.
Oh my God.
You have not seen the movie? No. I will not say anything else.
I will just say that the less, energy wasted talking about Nocturnal Animals in any capacity, but certainly as far as awards are concerned, the better, because that
when
is
camp
all
goes wrong,
we'll never get back.
Oui.
Tom Ford is nominated for Best Director at the Golden Globe.
Well, he bought
them all like bottles of perfume. So.
Yeah, he like scented his letters to the
But
HFPA.
they had to send the perfume back.
Boo.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so let me dig into the television side, which is typically even more insane than movies. The Westworld nominations were really weird. They had Evan Rachel Wood in lead actress and then Tandy Newton in supporting actress, which doesn't really make any sense to me. I don't know if us Westworld people want to make anything about that.
I guess if you are in the first scene of a show, you're automatically the lead. So the first shot was Dolores, so Evan Rachel Wood.
So the lead of Game of Thrones is that White Walker guy.
Yeah, exactly. And he's been nominated every year. Yeah. Logic.
Gael Garcia Bernal once again got nominated for Mozart in the Jungle, a show that the Golden Globes may have made up. And Billy Bob Thornton got nominated for Goliath, which I know is an Amazon series. I have never spoken to literally anyone who saw it. Do you guys have any of you guys
Do
seen
not
this?
Talk which to one? Dad?
Goliath? My dad, like, my dad does not know how to watch it.
The main guy from Gargoyles.
I mean, it's like David
that
Ant.
Is a nice callback.
David Keith, Keith David, Keith David.
David Keith.
Yeah, Goliath.
So nope. That's a show.
We live
like,
again.
I didn't realize you were such a Gargoyles fan.
Are you fucking kidding me? Gargoyles taught me everything I ever learned about Shakespeare. It's true. Anyone remembers the Macbeth arc? Come on.
Well, next week we're going to talk about gargoyles, obviously. Those are the highlights. And then the Golden Globes, on TV side, there's People vs. O.J. Simpson and Game of Thrones and Veep and The Crown and lots of other things you'd expect. But those are kind of my favorite insane ones.
So who's going to win Best Pictures? Because we get two at the Golden Globes to wrap it up here.
Best Picture Drama is actually weird. I feel like they could go with something crazy. So the nominees are Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight.
What is the deal with Hacksaw Ridge? I need to catch up with this movie.
Hacksaw Ridge is a great question.
I thought we swore it off.
I thought Mel Gibson's comeback was not going to be this easy. And much like Donald Trump's election, it's way easier than any of us ever thought.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking about forgiveness and we talked about in the passenger segment, I would certainly never be in like the same room as Mel Gibson just because I'd be afraid for my own safety. But I have a very intense reaction to him and his ongoing career. And I have no interest in seeing Hell or High Water, which I also didn't like. Hacksaw Ridge, but I also...
Hell or High Water is not anti-Semitic,
yeah,
as far as I know.
But Hacksaw Ridge, I mean, I've seen and responded positively to movies that are made by tons of people I find reprehensible. Hacksaw Ridge just sounds like a nightmare. And I'm perfectly okay staying in the sounds-like category rather than seeing for myself, even though I have the DVD 5 feet from where I'm sitting.
I believe that someone compared it to the movie that Daniel Brühl is in Inglourious Basterds, but
real.
Yeah. Right. Not sold on it.
That sounds right.
No. Yeah. That could win Best Picture Drama, could be Lion, could be Moonlight. You know, you never know with these crazy people. In the comedy or musical thing, I think you get a little bit more predictable. You've got 20th Century Women, Deadpool, Florence Foster Jenkins, La La Land, and Sing Street. I mean, if La La Land doesn't win this.
I don't know. Deadpool.
Yeah, who
Deadpool, no. Best Picture.
Deadpool beating out La La Land would be my favorite weird twist of Oscar season, and I always root for weird twists, so bring it on.
Hey guys, this week we get to go back to the Star Wars universe with the first spin-off film, which is Rogue One, A Star Wars Story by Gareth Edwards. It was originally an anthology film, now it's a Star Wars story. It's actually a prequel to the first movie, A New Hope, which is what it's called, after a bunch of titling.
Don't
but
say that.
The prequels that you remember.
Yes, it's okay. It's definitely set in the time of the Empire that leads directly into 1977 Star Wars, big Star Destroyer coming over your head at the beginning of that movie. It is about the things that are in the opening crawl of the first Star Wars, which is the stealing of the Death Star plans that Princess Leia is carrying at the beginning of all of Star Wars cinematically. And this one focuses instead on Jyn Erso, who's Felicity Jones, and Diego Luna's Cassian, and Alan Tudyk's K2SO droid. He's sort of like a Imperial C-3PO that's been reprogrammed. Donnie Yen's Churrit Inwe. Baze, who is played by an actor whose name I'm blanking on right
now.
Jiang Wen from Zhang Yimou films. That was a nice find.
Yes, both of the Asian actors who end up being leads are highlights
Movie. I think it's safe to say that the casting in this Star Wars, the last Star Wars, and probably all future Star Wars is going to be impeccable.
Saves every movie, really does.
Yeah, it's been really nice to see the universe expand in this sort of way, and for some people,
and it's been really nice to see people really angry about how many women and minorities are in Star Wars.
Yeah,
that's been great,
especially. I think those are like especially baseless in the face of something like Rogue One, which has like nothing like gender or minority based on its mind.
But Dave, there are no girls in Star Wars. Come on.
Right. Fair enough.
No girls.
This is challenging that theory once again for a second Star Wars release in a row. Anyway, it's definitely a war film, more so than other Star Wars movies, in the sense that there isn't like a Jedi that's guarding something, and the Force isn't really split into like light or dark. It's more treated like a religion by a few characters who has like a Force mantra and whatnot. But as a, you know, large Star Wars fan, I enjoyed it, but it has like this middle act where a whole bunch of characters enter into it, where I think I know what they're thinking and feeling, and I'm trying to follow those motivations, and then a whole bunch of stuff explodes, and on the other end of that, suddenly they believe different things, and I'm not sure I really was able to track that, and I think the movie tries to do like some sleight of hand in that point with whatever reshoot editing happened to sort of pivot into a third act that may have significantly changed. That being said, the beginning, I really enjoy the setup for this little thing right up until Forrest Whitaker shows up and starts the perilous second act.
Dave, can you say the thing that Forrest Whitaker says?
Oh my God, is this what he says in the TV?
It's really good, but you have to do it with the voice.
I mean, I can't think of what he says in the ad because
Save the dream!
Everything is in that, like, Sai weird uptick
voice. Save the dream!
He's such a weird character. It didn't need to be a legacy, Star Wars legacy character. But anyway. And then the last part, the last final assault that's like a space battle slash beach battle is pretty much Gareth Edwards doing big action the way he does. But like other Gareth Edwards movies, soft on character in some points. So, you know, I'm like in a solid B+. It's not going to beat the original trilogy for me, but it's better than the prequels.
Do you feel like the movie Save the Dream?
I think
of Star Wars
will successfully allow them to spin off movies and maybe, depending on if some advancements in technology we'll talk about later.
Oh, will we ever?
Get pulled off. Will embolden them to do interesting things.
I don't know. I feel like I'll be interested to see how much money it makes, because I think there's confusion over why Ray doesn't show up, at least at my Thanksgiving dinner table.
Wait, really?
Oh, yeah. And I've heard people talk about this in movie lines and Facebook comments and all sorts of things.
Do you think that the confusion is more understandable now that you've seen the movie and seen how poor or little of an effort they've made to have it actually be a standalone story, how neatly it folds into the previously established episodes to the point where it feels a bit disingenuous that it is not an episode unto itself?
Now, you enjoyed this movie.
Did I?
Didn't you give it a positive review? I thought you
did. I gave it a C+. And we probably...
That's passing. That passes.
I think I would, over time, it will probably drift closer towards the C, as long as we're talking about arbitrary grades. But I was very frustrated by this movie. And long-term listeners of the podcast will know that I'm a big fan of at least one Gareth Edwards film. And I have said many times that I thought that this would be the best Star Wars movie, for me at least, to date, because I like Gareth Edwards' more majestic, still detached approach.
But nope, Attack of the Clones is still your favorite.
Exactly. And the trailer suggested that there was a sort of a raw, natural beauty to this film that has been absent from many, not all Star Wars movies by any stretch. And you saw it a little bit in the first act of Force Awakens, and of course it's there in A New Hope. And the first scene of this movie, I was like, yes, this is the Star Wars movie I've been waiting for. Just look at how the wind kicks up Ben Mendelsohn's cape. It's panoramic and organic, and it feels like you actually have real actors delivering dialogue that isn't super wooden, and there's pathos, and I don't know everything about how this is going to play out because I don't know who any of these characters are, and the movie is just one colossal misstep after another from there with great casting and some truly beautiful sequences. I love – none of the characters pay off, which for me is very frustrating because they introduce a number of them, perhaps too many. And again, Gareth Edwards' strength does not lie in great character work. Exactly. And unfortunately, this is not – not a pre-human, but like a human. It tries to at least be a human film.
I would enjoy it. Yeah.
It could have been a post-human movie if it was more of a war movie, more of a men on a mission and focused on factions of people and lots and lots of different characters kind of maneuvering around this plot to get the Death Star plans. And we get to see some of the rebellion. We get to see
captains
of the ships.
It's not about people at all. I mean, it's not. So Jyn Erso is the main character and her, the meat of the movie, after a very sloppily put together building a team first act that has some really strong highlights.
Doesn't even happen. Yeah. Like that's
and there's no logic to it. Collides. And like Donnie Yen being a badass is not enough to save an act, but it's very cool. Watching the Death Star being on a planet as the Death Star does a test firing is very cool, but only gets you so far. But the meat of the movie is, or at least should be, about Jyn Erso's transition from being privileged to the point where she doesn't need to personally concern herself with the Empire. And there's this great line where she says, someone's like, you know, it doesn't bother you to see the Empire's flag waving. And she's like, you know, I don't have to worry about it if you don't look up. And you know, she's had a traumatic childhood experience and she has complicated relationships with her father because it's Star Wars. And, you know, she doesn't really worry about that, and then something happens that makes the stakes personal for her, and it completely bungles that transition. We're left with another very boring protagonist, and while all of the side characters have fun affects and quirks, none of them are at all real. And so when the third act depends on your investment in them, it doesn't pay off at all. And this is something that Dave would probably not agree with, but just my approach to the series is that I don't understand the point of making this movie if you're not going to make a standalone film. Like I was under the impression that was the point of these Star Wars story, Star Wars adventure movies, and this ends up being a film that exists for no other reason than to take the fun out of a conversation that nerds have been having for decades, but B, to retcon one of the silliest details from the original Star Wars film, and just it's a 2-hour and 15-minute movie about a deliberate architectural oversight.
This is not. It true. Is true. This I pretty much agree with you.
All right, I'll take it
on all these points. Where you're not right is that this movie could have made more sense. This movie didn't have to be a response or a logic reversal. This movie could have been the Death Star movie. It could have starred the Death Star, and it should have. It should have been a movie about a weapon, about Oppenheimer, about these choices, and about a true rebellion. And we get traces of that movie, and it seems like at some point it may have existed. But it's been cookie-cuttered with more character and kind of trying to make it more like an episode Star Wars movie with character arcs and connections and all that. And yeah, ties back to the other films, but it should have really stood alone and been a Death Star movie. And I think that's when it's at its best. You know, what you were saying, seeing the Death Star take a life of its own, see the Empire inner workings, trying to get this thing off the ground, seeing how terrified the rebels are when this thing goes off for the first time, creates this mushroom cloud 1,000 times bigger than a nuke, and it's that's what Gareth Edwards.
And those effects are very cool.
Giant vistas. Yeah, the effects are amazing. And I guess we should probably transition to spoilers at some point, but I did want to say, you know, I think my reaction to The Force Awakens was kind of like, that was good. I'd have to go back to our review and see what I was thinking then. But over time, at least, I'm kind of like, that was a solid pitch right down the middle. Let's get Star Wars back going. It's exactly what people wanted. A glossy, nostalgic, new characters. Great. It was totally safe play. And this movie has higher highs and lower lows. I think Gareth Edwards is a visionary. And his like wide shots in this are unreal at times. It's so amazing. But some things are just such disasters, like really bad choices, character-wise and effects-wise.
Before we go into spoiler territory, I think it's fair to say that those choices are not isolated from one another. I think that the bad decisions regarding effects actually – I mean, they're bad story decisions that lead to bad effects decisions. And there's a little bit of an Ouroboros there.
I don't even want to say just effects. Yeah. I want to say like there are set pieces in the middle of the movie where I was just like, why are they on this planet? Why are they shooting at people? Why is any of this happening? I'm so lost. One scene takes place during like a big rainy planet at an Imperial base, and it just feels pointless. And you don't want something to kill the momentum of a Star Wars movie like that, especially a man on a mission movie that should have objectives and be drawing this team from point A to point B to point C and make logical sense. It's totally derails the movie. It's all chopped up.
So this is where we decide to talk.
Well, Dave,
about
I think
this is where we're going to talk about the spoilers.
I want to know what the thing is. I haven't seen it, but
I want to see if Dave has more to say about just the movie in general, or to take us into the segment, because
I mean, I don't disagree with what you guys are talking about, in the sense, especially with like the characters sort of disappearing. And I definitely agree with Patches that you know, half of what's in the trailers isn't in the movie anymore. And like some of the stuff that I really liked from the trailers, like, you know, Krennic's white cape dragging through the ocean as he walks up the beach, like isn't in the movie. Or Jin holding the hard drive and like running at the AT-ATs on the ground level, like isn't in the movie. And so a lot of the stuff that I was like sort of sold on that made this feel like a standalone war movie that is going to have Jyn Erso be like at the front of it, didn't pan out. Instead, what I got is answers to a lot of questions I had about the original Star Wars trilogy, which I was enjoying as a Star Wars fan, but I totally think that people's mileage is going to vary on how much they enjoy those tidbits.
So,
what we're going to talk about
spoiler,
right now.
Spoiler, spoiler, spoiler,
dot, spoiler. Dot, spoiler, but this is the mid, also a first act thing. We're not talking about the end of the movie here necessarily.
We thought it would have been a spoiler cameo, and then it became something much worse.
So,
is it Darth Vader?
No, not even. Darth Vader, he's more of a cameo.
I will preface this by saying that I've been accused of being prone to hyperbole. I tend to think that I vet my thoughts about such things better than people give me credit for, but whatever. It's not up for me to decide. I think that this one detail is maybe not worse, but as bad of a decision when you consider it from all sides, not just aesthetically, but also ethically and its purpose and its needlessness, as anything I can remember seeing in a movie of this size. But Peter Cushing died in 1994. And
Peter Cushing, who played
Dave. Thank
you. Tarkin.
He was Darth Vader. The only, and please do correct me if I'm wrong, because God forbid I live my life with misinformation regarding Star Wars lore. But he was the only person on the Death Star who had a higher rank than Darth Vader when the Emperor was not there. So, yeah. And so I suppose to that extent, he is a character that is important if you're making already your first mistake to make a movie about that feeds so directly into New Hope. Anyway, he died in 1994. He is a major character in this film. A major character.
Yeah.
It is not a cameo. It is not one scene. He is a major character. He
probably has as much screen time as Ben Mendelsohn. Nah, maybe a little less, but like Ben Mendelsohn's part is not very big in this movie. I was surprised. I wanted him to be more sinister and looming over everything.
This is exactly what we meant when talking about how the problems of the story feed into the effects and vice versa, is that this would be, and this is, I think, the most important thing before we get into this conversation, a significantly better film if Moff Tarkin was not in it at all as a character. It would be a better screenplay if he weren't in it, if perhaps he had been limited to a scene in like a hologram or something. Because he cannibalizes all of Ben Mendelsohn's screen time, his purpose, his conflict. There is no main villain in this movie because the main villain is eaten alive by zombie Peter Cushings, who, to the more direct point, looks hilariously bad. I mean, it's so distracting that not only could I not pay attention to literally anything that came out of his mouth, but for at least the following scene after all of his scenes, I was just slowly trying to reaffix my jaw to my face because I couldn't
believe that this happened. He looks like Gru. Like the same animation that brings Gru to life in the Despicable Me movies, it brings Peter Cushing back to life.
It's as inexplicable a decision. Like the fact that there were multiple people on multiple levels who not only thought this would be a good idea, agreed that ethically, whatever the contracts are, we will never know, whatever agreements were worked out with his, his trust, what do they call it when you're famous and you die? His family, whatever the case might be, whatever papers were signed. There are definitely some ethical quandaries here of just resurrecting actors willy-nilly and giving them new words to say. I'm not sure about that bit of the technology. Stories, Disney has been very tight about the stories about the actual technology coming out, I guess supposedly to preserve plot points, but you'll see those towards the end of the month. But a lot of people had to say yes for this to happen, and then a lot of people had to say that looks good enough to send out to the world. It makes Jar Jar Binks look like fucking Laurence Olivier. I mean, it is a all-time disaster.
Dave, is it really that bad?
Laurence Olivier, specifically in Sky Captain and World Tomorrow, where he was brought back to life.
Which is why I'm a perfect example.
I think this is hyperbole on David's part. I don't want to discount the any sort of ethical emotional reaction, because I think we're gonna have to deal with that as a society. But in terms of I planted the Pirates of the Caribbean factoid earlier in this episode to bring up that Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow is a property that Disney owns now. They own his likeness, they own his voice doing the character, that's a property thing now. And so even though we're not constructing a photorealistic actual resurrection, I feel it was good enough to put Tarkin in the story that way, and I believed that as much as I believed Darth Vader with old James Earl Jones's distorted voice coming out of it.
His voice sounds so different.
Oh,
I was
God.
Shocked.
That's another.
Well, but those are the one is legitimate and one is a facsimile. And this movie allows those lines, or starts those lines, to be blurred. But this is always going to be this was always the end game since, you know, I don't know, Rise of the Planet of the Apes was the first time I remember talking to anybody. Andy Serkis was big in saying that digital resurrection was going to be where it was. And so you basically have an actor doing an impression, not necessarily of the actor, but of the character. And so instead of, you know, in the future, instead of casting Ewan McGregor as a young Alec Guinness, you're going to have a guy who does a really good Alec Guinness impression or who walks like Alec Guinness, and then they're going to reconstruct it. But it's like, it's the same thing that was done at the beginning of Superman Returns with Marlon Brando.
Although it's interesting that it doesn't look more like Josh Pence in The Social Network when they slapped Armie Hammer's face onto him. I mean, they have Peter Cushing. They have all this real footage. Can't you just kind of like MS Paint his face onto this other actor? And I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think they did. I think the things that you see that are weird is when it's obviously someone doing a Grand Moff Tarkin impression and not Peter Cushing doing the character. So when he smiles wrong, you notice that because your brain is projecting the character at you. I don't know what, like, if you take like a 12-year-old kid to this and, you know, show it to him, I don't know if he's going to feel any weirder about that, because Tarkin's been around in animated form for like 2 years now.
When he's standing still, he actually looks okay to me,
but the eyes,
weird.
It's in his cold dead eyes. The eyes are never good.
I mean, but I think the eyes are real is the thing. Like, I think that's a person.
Whatever. I mean, I'm sure the eyes were real at some point, but whatever.
No, those were Jerry Orbach's eyes.
Well, however, they are like rattling back and forth. And the same problem, we don't Moff Tarkin is not the only character who is brought back.
We are full spoilers.
No, that's all I'm
going
to say. That's all. We are full spoilers. I don't know why. We don't have to be.
I kind of want to.
I can tell you off podcast. I mean, maybe you're still listening because you want to dip a toe in the water, but you don't want like the last shot of the movie ruined. There are other characters who come back who were not, you know, the actors playing themselves, and the eyes are also a problem for them. You could tell it instantly. They rattle and warble back and forth erratically in their heads. It's just a colossal fuck up.
Jesus.
It's like this is a...
I mean, I want to see this again because...
Totally.
Did you see it in 2D or 3D?
The second one,
okay,
I saw it in 2D. Okay, so the second one, I definitely agree, is not good and also not needed.
Interesting, like the second one, it looks better to me.
No, because I think the when they're doing Grand Moff Tarkin, like, lighting that face on the Death Star is, like, so easy. It's, like, top lighting, it's major cheekbones, it's, you know, finding the space in between the brow where the wrinkles are, and his darting eyes. I don't see, like, that's why it worked for me, is because, I don't know, maybe it's because I think so much in, like, cartoons, it's like, that was on model enough that it's not, like, offensive. It's like, that's what happens when you bring a character back.
But the,
and,
as
you know,
kind
it's going to be weird to see when the Han Solo movie, where they've cast, you know, completely different people that look nothing like it, when they also have taken this option
for another
spin-off
movie. Will it be weird, or will it be
it's
hugely
be...
refreshing after this?
I mean, it depends.
Well, it's
going to
be weird because they're going to paste Harrison Ford's face onto Alden Ehrenreich or whatever his name is.
Well, I mean, if this works, it's, you know, oh, it's a barrel of monkeys that, you know, it's going to fuck things up for blockbuster movies.
I mean, I'm not saying that this is, I'm not denying the future. I'm not saying that this is going to be technology one day that will work. I'm saying that day is not now, and the time was not right, and we've certainly not sifted through the ethical morass of it all.
Well, to kind of bring it back to the bigger picture, what you said, David, is exactly right. This whole Peter Cushing thing, it just seems to poison everything around it, and even people who don't share screen time with him. I'm just like, why am I looking at this concoction when I want to spend more time with Jyn Erso? Like, I think Felicity Jones and Diego Luna are pretty good in this movie and deserve to have some more scenes.
You were just saying it should be the story of the Death Star, and if you're going to tell the story of the Death Star, it involves Tarkin, because,
but
like, even, I don't want to... The stupid thing about this movie is, like, all the good character parts are in the fucking novels leading up to it, and then it, you know, does the movie and then pushes it, like, directly so you want to watch A New Hope, like, afterwards, just so you could continue that high that you briefly started to get. But, like, the Tarkin needed to be in there... Krennic needed to be in there. Mads Mickelson's character needed to have the arc that he did, but I don't know if like enough of it is actually in Rogue One for the.
But can you
making up for it is every Mon Calamari in this movie. There are so many Mon Calamari.
Can you, Dave, can you agree that even if you think Moff Tarkin had to be in this movie, and you know if you're going to tell this story, I'm happy to concede that point. That this is still probably the worst possible way of integrating him, that like they could have shot him in a hologram. They could have shot him from behind. They could have done whatever.
You're really hung up on Moff Tarkin.
I mean, it's a movie ruining thing. It's like a historically bad, it's as big a stain on Star Wars as Jar Jar ever was, as Jabba being edited into the special editions of A New Hope ever was. It is an all time disaster.
I don't think it's as bad as Jabba or like Han not shooting first. Like, I think that those things that you're talking about are like going back and like fucking with cinema.
This isn't going back and fucking with cinema.
New direction. No, well, I think
it's
a brand
story.
It's a pre-existing
character.
He's dead. He's dead.
Yeah, but I mean, this isn't like, he isn't like dancing with a dustbuster to like sell a product. That's a character that Disney owns. They can make Moff Tarkin
so
any way they want.
In this case,
they made him actually look like the actor.
I mean, I'm sure that when Peter Cushing signed whatever contracts he signed, he did not realize that his likeness, which he did, first of all, I had no idea that Disney would ever own it, but second of all, realized what likeness could entail. But I do think that while it,
oh, yeah. And I mean, it's interesting that it's happening with Star Wars, because Star Wars is like the beginning of blockbuster films being about the licensing and the likenesses. So, like, this is definitely the battle to have this discussion with.
Is it ever
going to
be the cultural embarrassment that Jar Jar Binks was? No, not on that level. But as far as being a needless decision that ruined, like, really is like, I really am, this word ruin, I think, overused, I'm sure by myself, certainly by others as well, but it's just one of those rare details that I think, that not that there aren't myriad other problems in this movie that we've discussed, and a number of things that I think work very well about it. There are a number of beautiful shots throughout the movie, even if a lot of the best ones from the trailer don't appear in it, as Patch has said, that are Gareth Edwards through and through, and give a real sense of scope to this movie, and the battles, what they do with the destroyers is cooler than anything they've ever even come close to doing in these previous movies. But I do really feel like this is one of those that ruins a movie.
I mean, I will say that the one thing I'll concede to you and Patches is that even if it's not horrible to you, even if you're excited by it, Ben Mendelsohn's character gets completely lost by the fact that he has to get set against
either
Tarkin or Vader.
Yes. The like, CG is not
those are the two people.
Movie destroying. It is not the Death Star to this movie's planning, but how it undermines everything else. I mean, I have a bigger problem with how many planets they go to than I do Moff Tarkin in this movie. There's so many other things to complain about.
There are.
Come on. But if you like Kyber crystals, this is the movie for you.
Well, and Catalyst, the novel that leads into it, is really the book for you, because that's all about the light and or the day and night lattices of the Kyber crystals.
Oh my God, who knew
Patches,
that the Death Star was running on Jedi crystals? The lightsabers and the Death Star are made of the same thing. Oh my God.
So much background reading to do.
But can we, just to end on a positive note, can we say that, again, asterisk, if they had to make this movie, which I wish they hadn't, I wish that, and this is why I'm looking forward to the Han Solo movie, because I'm fingers crossed, it's more of like a Cowboy Bebop, space bounty hunters off doing their own thing, with only occasional winks to this, and maybe all the music won't just be all the Star Wars music you already know, but with like one
what
discordant
a disappointment.
Note.
What a disappointment from Giacchino.
It's terrible. It's terrible. He should be embarrassed. It's terrible. It's such a hack job.
I mean,
anyway,
didn't he do it in like 2 weeks though? So
he must have.
I don't know if we could totally blame him.
Well, because wasn't Desplat on this?
Yeah, Desplat was on that. Yeah. He made the right move, I guess. Well, you know why they hired him? Because they wanted the Zero Dark Thirty score again. Mm-hmm. And they hired the Zero Dark Thirty cinematographer. And there are definitely moments in this movie that look like Zero Dark Thirty. There's a lot of spycraft in this movie.
But I do think that, again, if you had to make this movie, the way that they passed the baton from this to episode 4, aside from the very last shot and the special effects involved, is very satisfying, I think, especially for fans.
You mean the mayhem of the sequence?
Yeah, just like the stab of urgency that they give it.
Word.
Appropriate word.
That's good. Good job, guys.
Rogue One. It's another Star Wars
movie. You're probably going to see it.
I'm going to see it, despite the fact that I haven't seen it as we record this. I do plan to see it, so stay tuned. In a couple months, I'll have my opinions on Rogue One.
Watch out!
I've got it all. That does it. This week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week with our top tens of the year. It's a fun episode. It's a long one. I guess it'll probably be 2 episodes. Don't we usually split in half, Dave?
Yeah, I think we'll split it in half and, have a holiday week for us off, but that's an episode that posts.
We earned it.
There we go. Yeah, we worked so hard. So anyway, we'll be back then. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com. We can listen to the episodes, share them, leave us comments that we'll probably read on the show if we remember to look at them, and all sorts of things. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find my Star Wars review on IndieWire I can't imagine you'd be able to stomach any more of my thoughts about this movie, but there they are. And you can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room. And if you want a sneak preview of at least my top 10, you can find it on the internet now. New video form.
It's a good one. You're being so humble about it.
So humble.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name DA7E. That's also my Twitter handle, where you should follow me for new stuff from Geek and Thrillist in the upcoming week. All over on Star Wars Spoilers, we just talked about Rogue One. We're going to spend the rest of this year talking about our favorite holiday stuff, and then an episode about the best television that we all thought happened this year, which, you know, I'm really struggling because I think BoJack Horseman is going to eke his way on there after I didn't see that season when we talked about it on the show. So cheers, David.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com. And I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where we talk to you and each other and talk about this week's lightning round question, which we'll retweet if you answer it. What was it?
In honor of Collateral Beauty, what's a movie with a plot that needs to be seen to be believed?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back with our top 10 next week.
I'm so humble. Watch out!